Hey, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David. Since the pandemic hit and made touring and performing impossible, I've taken to broadcasting interviews with people who I can't visit in person anymore. They're live streamed most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KABU Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon. All these interviews also then go out in podcast form afterwards, which you can find if you look up This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform, or just go to davidrovics.com. I also do a live concert from my living room on the last Saturday of each month at 1 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. GMT. Today, we're spending the hour with Mazen Kumsia, who is talking to us from occupied Palestine in the West Bank, where he is the director of the Palestine Museum of Natural History. In a very busy life, Mazen is an accomplished scientist who was a professor at Yale University when we first met around 20 years ago, back when I lived in New Haven. While being a professor and publishing lots of scientific papers, he also authored books about the occupation of Palestine, and he was also involved with a whole lot of organizing of speaking tours under the banner of Wheels of Justice, and he got arrested a fair number of times as well, according to the internet. I hadn't known about the arrest record, but I saw you being handcuffed online just this morning. Good to see you, Mazen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show, David.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. And I have a zillion questions, approximately. But how is the museum going? How it hasn't been bombed yet, so that's a good that's a good thing.
No, not yet. We do make precautions for this, and we back up our systems also. But no, we are the museum. It's a museum of natural history, but it's also an institute for biodiversity and sustainability. And the idea is, how can we ensure sustainability of the communities here, communities of people and communities of animals and plants? So basically, it's about sustainability, about survival in very, very difficult circumstances, as you all are well aware. Palestinian areas have been under Israeli occupations for decades. Military occupation, but it's more than a military occupation. It's a colonization where they actually take the land and the property and the natural resources, and they turn them over to immigrants from Europe and elsewhere who are coming over here. So we, the Palestinian natives, contend with this every day for the past seven, eight decades. Today, there are 13 million Palestinians, 7.5 million of them are refugees or displaced people. And the rest live in cantons like Bethlehem, where I'm speaking to you now from Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus. Basically, we are in a canton. We're not allowed to move even to Jerusalem, which is only 4 kilometers away from here. We cannot get to Jerusalem, and I used to be a high school teacher in Jerusalem. I can't get to Jerusalem. So it's a very difficult life, but the museum and the institute are a beacon of hope for the people. And today we had about a dozen people at the museum, volunteers and staff working very hard, building a playground, watering the plants in our community garden, taking care of, taxidermy, doing animal studies, research, publishing papers. I just finished a paper on orchids in Palestine. So we keep essentially a hopeful trend and a hopeful atmosphere. It's like an oasis in the middle of this mayhem.
Yeah, and there's a lot of internationals who come to the museum regularly. Huh?
Well, we used to get a lot of internationals. On average, we used to have between 8 and 10 people at one time, staying with us, working with us, etc. But with the COVID-19 pandemic, which has kind of paralyzed global travel, basically we have a very minimal number of people can be here. We have actually an Israeli volunteer who's long-term staying with us. So that's closer if you want. But it's difficult. It's very difficult to get international volunteers on campus at Bethlehem University and on the museum grounds and in the garden. So we do some volunteering from abroad. People help us from abroad, either technical help or database management and other things.
And you have a U.S. passport still, right? But that doesn't help you get to Jerusalem.
No. The U.S. passport is king around the world, except if it's held by a Palestinian, and it's a worthless piece of trash, basically, because Israel treats Palestinian Americans as they treat all other Palestinians, or if you want, non-Jewish natives here, whether they are Christian or Muslim or anything. They treat us as 10th-class citizens, unwanted, basically.
When you mentioned the cantons and not being able to travel, you know, one of the things that struck me when I was there in 2005 was how so much of the suffering is invisible. You know, like in the sense that, like, I think when I was in Nablus, I remember hearing that there's only two taxis that are allowed to leave Nablus. And so none of the other cars try to leave Nablus, so because they know they're not allowed to. So, it struck me that, you know, for all the people that come to visit, sometimes looking for obvious signs of the horrors of the occupation in terms of violence and this sort of thing, so much of the suffering is not actually visible to a visitor.
It's very hard to describe it to people who do not come here. You came here, so you saw for yourself. What you see is symptoms of colonization. It's not unusual in situations of colonization to have those kinds of activities that persistently violate the human rights of the natives. In South Africa, under apartheid, for example, we were used to seeing how blacks were prevented from moving from one Bantustan to the other, the permit system, etc. But the situation here is actually worse than apartheid in South Africa when it was active apartheid. Because not only do we have Bantustans, ghettos, if you want, we also have walls, we have fences around us. And South Africa, despite all its horrors as an apartheid regime against the native people, they never used F-16s to bomb communities like Soweto and so forth. Whereas here they do this regularly, and they also apply blockade. For example, Gaza, which is a strip of land along the Mediterranean, semi-arid region, 2 million Palestinian natives are there. Two-thirds of them are refugees pushed out of their homes and lands in 1948. Prevented from returning, even though this is international law that they have a right to return to their homes and lands. And yet, as this besieged 2 million population, they are prevented even from getting basic medicines. And now COVID-19, the pandemic, has reached Gaza. And it's really, I mean, I couldn't sleep last night thinking about population in Gaza because they cannot do physical distancing. Social distancing. There are 2 million people crammed into a very small area, one of the densest areas in the world, basically. So imagine how the COVID-19 is now going to spread in Gaza. And not only that, they don't have medical facilities because Israel applies blockade to Gaza. They don't have sources of income. Even last night, a friend from Gaza called me. He says his children haven't had anything to eat except bread for the past 3 days, 4 days. They cannot have anything else, you know, and they beg for bread, basically. So we sent them a little bit of money this morning, but it's really very, very hard for most people of Gaza. They don't have income. They don't have any support.
And they have no clean water, and they're being bombed by Israeli jets.
Absolutely. The world is silent about it. Of course, the mainstream media doesn't talk about Gaza because much of the mainstream media is run by people who have corporate or Zionist interest, and this is not on the radar even.
I wonder, just slightly switching gears, like in your time teaching at Yale University, which my grandfather also went studied at Yale, and I mean it's known for being the home of the State Department and the establishment in the United States, right? I mean that's the pale male, and Yale is the sort of stereotypical State Department description. But teaching at Yale, I mean, with somebody from your background, with your understanding of reality in the world, you must have been. It must have been, I mean, as difficult as life is living under occupation, it must have been emotionally extremely difficult to have day-to-day interactions with people who probably wish that you didn't exist.
Well, my time in the USA in general and my time at Duke University and at Yale University, both of them still have hallways named after slave owners and so forth. In every country, including this one, Palestine, which is now, renamed Israel, if you want, every country has this contradiction, and there's this tug of war at our hearts. On the one hand, for example, in the U.S., whether at Yale or at Duke, you see brilliant activists, young people doing brilliant work, and you also see establishment at Yale, skull and bone kind of thing, and ideas of world domination and militarism and corporate. My son also went to MIT, and at MIT there are brilliant people doing good work, but there's also whole sections and whole buildings that are dedicated to researching the best way to kill people, you know? So it is... It's this duality of our lives, whether it's at Yale or at Duke or in the U.S. in general, or even here. The duality here is to see people like Netanyahu, who spouts very racist things against Palestinians and bombs Gaza and kills people. And then you see people like Zohar, which is an Israeli volunteer at our museum, as I told you, working with us very hard. Watering the plant, and she also has a missing leg, actually. So it's amazing that how she does what she does. So we are always faced with this duality, good people doing great things, and then horrible people who just want to harm other people to get rich and richer. And when they get their first million, they want 10 million. When they get 100 million, they want a billion, and so on. Their greed doesn't seem to stop. This is the duality we have to face.
What was it that led you to decide to? I mean, I don't know if it was already in your plan, if you had it all planned out in advance. But when you left Yale University and went back to Palestine to open up the museum that you're running now, what went into that decision?
I've never wanted to stay in the U.S. permanently from the time I went to the U.S. And actually getting my U.S. citizenship was an accidental thing that the hospital I was working for wanted to get me citizenship. But anyways, my idea was always to come back. What kept me actually so long in the U.S., more than a quarter century, which is far longer than I wanted to, was that I realized that the work in the U.S. is very, very important. The U.S. is really a superpower, militarily, economically, et cetera, and it was so for the past several decades, American century, they used to call the 20th century. So it is really important because the U.S. was controlling destiny and destroying so many countries. During my stay in the U.S. alone, in those little over a quarter of a century, I saw the U.S. engage in at least 10 wars that resulted in the deaths of millions of people. And this is just my own experience, physically. And I saw it also with their effect on places like Iraq, where I have many friends, half a million Iraqi children were killed just by the sanctions that the U.S. applied on Iraq in the 1990s, and then engaging in a war in 2003 on the people of Iraq that resulted in half a million deaths, also of civilians I'm talking about, and the war of the U.S. on Yemen through their puppets like the Saudi and United Arab Emirate regimes, their war on Libya, their war on Syria, their war on Afghanistan, and so on and so forth. So I realized that the U.S. is very important, and it's important to affect U.S. policy. That's why we engaged in things like you saw when you actually came and played music and other things on the Wheels of Justice bus tour and other things to try and influence public opinion in the U.S. And we did. We succeeded somewhat in influencing public opinion. Why I moved back when I did, which is 2008, to Palestine, is simply a calculation on my part that, okay, I'm useful in the U.S., I'm useful in Palestine, but at that point, I figured I would be more useful in Palestine than I would be in the U.S. And it was a very good move, the best move in my life. I gave up a six-figure income to come to a two- or three-figure income. but it was the best move in my life.
I'm trying to think, what is a two or three in figure income? Okay.
only if I teach a course, I may get a few hundred dollars. And right. I don't teach very often, you know?
No online teaching? You could be teaching online at Yale now.
No, I don't. No, I want to focus on activism.
Yeah. But you know, when you talk about the influence of the U.S., I often feel like these conversations about what is going on in Palestine mm-hmm. and what Israel is doing. I mean, I often feel like it's almost pointless to talk about it and pointless to drag somebody like you through another conversation like this, because it's like if U.S. foreign policy doesn't change, then is it possible for anything to change? You know, it just occurs to me like. And reading about the Lebanese civil war back in the day, like, I mean, it was a proxy war. It's so much, it's being fought by major powers. With all the support for Israel that the U.S. Gives, it's not like a conflict or a problem that could possibly be resolved without the U.S. stopping its support for Israel. Is that a fair statement, you'd say?
Well, yes, but let me paint a bigger picture here. Look at the forest, if you want. It's not just Israel. I mean, there is a situation which has existed for hundreds of years where great empires built their power on the subjugation of other people. Belgium, for example, in the Congo, Britain in the Middle East, and other countries in India, the Opium Wars on China, and so forth. Empires like Britain, France, Spain, Portugal, and now the U.S. have always subjugated and benefited and profited, not as a people of those countries, by the way, but as the elites who run those countries like Britain or the U.S. They always profited from what they were doing. This is the way the world worked for many hundreds of years. The problem now, of course, is that we can, as a species, we cannot afford this anymore. And with nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction, and the fact that every single war, recent wars, have killed more civilians than military people, and this percentage of civilian to military ratio, if you want, the ratio of civilians killed to the military people killed, has been increasing over the past few hundred years, so that it's now roughly 98% of the people killed in these wars are civilians, not fighting people even. So it is no longer really sustainable like it used to be in the past. Add to that, of course, climate change and human-induced environmental catastrophe that we are witnessing. And you can see that we as a species can no longer afford empires, can no longer afford with the 1% ruling the 99%, whether it's in America or Britain or anywhere else. So it is really time for us to declare a change, a revolution a change of the system. Palestine is emblematic and is important in one aspect. In the same way that South Africa was emblematic and central in the 1980s, we Palestinians have become this lightning rod for people who want, on the one hand, the 1% who want to sacrifice us and basically remove us from the picture completely, even if it includes genocide. And there is the other people who see that Palestine actually provides litmus test for the West and for the way we proceed as a species, just like South Africa. In South Africa, why did we all mobilize for South Africa to liberate itself from apartheid? We did it because it was emblematic of the hypocrisy of the West. Western countries were saying how South Africa was, you know, the only democracy in Africa, how it was modern, how it has technology, and how, you know, the blacks are, you know, just communists, savages, terrorists. And South Africa was recognized as, I don't know how to describe it, a poster child for Western imperialism. And Ronald Reagan, for example, when he came to power in 1980, he gave a speech. He said South Africa is a great friend. Nelson Mandela is a terrorist. These people should be kept in jail forever. And we don't want South Africa to tumble. And then we will have a domino effect of communists running over all of Africa. This is the same language you hear now about Palestine. And by the way, this language is accompanied, on the other hand, by these Western countries claiming they support democracy and they support human rights. Well, if they support democracy and support human rights, why did they support apartheid in South Africa, all the way, by the way? And why do they support apartheid in Palestine today, a Jewish state that discriminates against non-Jews? Why do they do that if they are really for democracy and for human rights? So there's this... you know, contradiction that's becoming obvious to more people. And that's why people focus on Palestine. That's why I think you see Palestinian flags in Brazil or Argentina or other places. When they, even in India, poor areas, I've saw Palestinian flags because they see it as basically the Achilles heel of Western hypocrisy.
Yeah, the Achilles heel. It's emblematic, as you say, and it's so hard to even think about how to imagine that that Reagan would have made such statements about South Africa, apartheid South Africa, back in 1980. It would be so it would be hard to imagine at least up to maybe 2 or 3 years ago, it would be hard to imagine even any prominent Republican or Democrat in the U.S. saying nice things about apartheid South Africa, right? But
they used to. I mean, you look at the New York Times even and Washington Post in that era, even to the last day, they continued to support apartheid. They stopped supporting apartheid when they were 100% sure that it's failing, it's going. And that it is already gone. Basically, there's an agreement between de Klerk and Mandela, and that apartheid is ending. That's the only day that they actually changed. Till the last day, they still thought apartheid was good. And the hypocrisy of seeing Western leaders go to the funeral of Nelson Mandela and saying that, oh, but we've always supported the freedom for blacks in South Africa, which is nonsense. BS, sorry, Annie. They used to just, every single Western country, and I challenge anybody to prove me wrong, every single Western country was lined up with apartheid South Africa, financially, economically, politically, in every way. And as they are now with Israel, I am sure when we finally have our freedom, and we will, that the West will also say we've always been with the freedom of the Palestinians. Mm. When you hear them now and you know what they are talking about, when Trump says, you know, Jerusalem is capital of Israel, settlements are legal, the annexation of the Golan is legal, which is against international law, and that the refugees don't have a right to return to their homes and lands, also against international law. Not just against international law. Settlements are a war crime. It's a crime against humanity. Every single illegal settler on Palestinian land is essentially a war criminal, should be tried at The Hague. And yet, you see President Trump appoint one of those settlers to be, ironically, U.S. ambassador to Israel, Friedman, what's his first name? I forget.
Right.
But Friedman is a settler. You know, this is bizarre, you know. A war criminal is appointed as an ambassador from the U.S. to the state that he represents.
No, really,
Friedman, yeah, you know, Friedman doesn't represent U.S. interests, even though he's an American. But he's a dual citizen. He has Israeli citizenship, and his loyalty lies with Israel. It doesn't lie with the U.S.
I mean, even much of the Israeli press thinks that these kinds of appointments are bizarre. I mean, even when Bush when Bush had his delegation of three wealthy American Jews, and the Israeli press were calling them the three Jews, you know, like, because, you know, this is just, do you really have to send these particular people to represent American interests? It's kind of like, you know, your bias is showing just a bit, you know. But back in
the U.S., you're right also in the sense that the U.S. administration is more Zionist than many Zionists here in Palestine.
Right.
More right-wing radical Zionists than most of the Zionists here.
Yeah.
At least some of the Zionists here, they understand there's another people here that they have to deal with. The U.S. right-wing Zionists, like the son-in-law of Donald Trump, Mr. Kushner, is so far to the right. He's essentially a fascist. He's worse than any neo-Nazi that I know, because they advocate ethnic cleansing openly, not even hidden. They advocate genocide, as in Gaza. They advocate massive bombings of civilian areas. This is not even, you know, even moderate Zionists, if you want to call them that, even though they are for it, at least they don't express it verbally, you know. They are very careful and circumspect in their language.
When you were here in 2000, when the Second Intifada kicked off and Sharon's visit to the mosque and the massacre there, one of so many massacres, it was really quite an exceptional period internationally, wasn't it? For a while there, for I would say maybe about a year, it was almost pretty much exactly 1 year. It was there was a lot of activity around solidarity with Palestine and a lot of media talking about it that had never talked about it with anything but a completely biased pro-Israeli view before, and they were starting to talk about Palestinians as human beings for about a year there, it seemed like. And that was a lot. I also, there were just so many Palestinians coming out of the woodwork in American society. Like, I mean, I didn't even realize there were so many Palestinians in the U.S. There were so many people in the streets. But that faded away pretty quickly after 9/11. But what was it like being around here in the U.S. during that time? Did you feel momentarily hopeful for the future?
Well, I'm writing now, almost finished a book about my life in the U.S.
Oh, great.
Not an autobiography, more about interactions and people and activism in the U.S. and how it is. And the most difficult period I was writing about was 2000-2001.
Mm-hmm.
In those 2 years, really, I mean, literally, the world changed and Palestine changed. Everything changed. September 11, no matter what we think about it, really changed the world, changed the perception of so many people. You know, it was amazing, actually. I had friends in New York, and I was living about an hour away from New York at the time, to witness those things and to witness what was happening around me. And then to see immediately after that, incredible solidarity and positive action and interest among the American public By contrast, also, to go back to this contrast that we always see in our societies, to see how vicious and mean the 1%, if you want, and they're actually much less than 1%, 0.01% maybe, of the population turned against Arabs, against Arab Christian, Arab Muslims, against Muslims even who are not Arab, like from Pakistan or Indonesia, anybody who's a Muslim, became a target after September 11, not by the general public. General public wanted to actually know more. They became a target by those elites, by the Zionists, by the corporate media, by Fox News, and by idiots like Donald Trump and people around him, and the George Bushes of the world. And you know, this is the again that duality that tugs at our hearts. So you asked me about my feelings at the period. At the period, is like everything else. You are subjected to these differing tugs on you and on your mind and on your heart. Extreme hate from somebody. The FBI even investigated me and so forth. The Zionists were sending me hate mail and death threats. And on the other hand, you see this beautiful solidarity of common people of various religions and backgrounds and cultures and so forth. And you say to yourself, okay, why is the world like this? Why couldn't everybody be nice? You know, why do we have those mean people who are getting rich off of the misery of others? This is always the case, and it's always this tug of war. It intensifies during periods like 2000, 2001, when we saw, for example, Israel bombing refugee camps and CNN and Fox News coming and saying, well, Israel is bombing terrorist targets. Terrorist targets in the dense refugee camp that flattens a third of the refugee camp of Jenin, this is a terrorist target that kills hundreds of innocent civilians. Is this targeting terrorists? Or the U.S. in Afghanistan right after September 11 when they were bombing civilians? Or when they went into Iraq in 2003, supposedly because they didn't like Saddam Hussein, but it's really because they wanted to serve Israel, Israeli and corporate interests. This is
this narrative that you still hear it, even about Saddam Hussein and about like things that happened way, way after the fall of the Soviet Union. This Cold War narrative is still so popular over here. It's completely misleading. Huh? Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not new in the world history. I mean, when the Europeans colonized the U.S., which I consider my second country, as you pointed out, I have a U.S. passport. I consider it my second country. And I came as an immigrant, so I felt also that I'm partaking of the privilege that the U.S. was built as a privileged society for certain people. But if I think about the U.S. and its history and how it has developed and so forth, what do I see? When they came, for example, and started butchering Native Americans, millions of Native Americans, what did they write? They wrote how they circled the wagons, protected themselves from those savages who are painting their faces red, screaming, yelling, coming to scalp men and women and children. This is the lingo of colonialism that was prevalent then. There was no TV and CNN and Fox News, but it's a lingo that we are very familiar with from the history of colonization. And the only difference today is that there's mainstream media and internet that magnifies this world view of colonialism and justifies it, makes it all legitimate. After all, Israel is defending itself by killing thousands of Palestinians. After all, the refugees left. We didn't force them to leave. They left on their own. Well, why can't you let them back? Well, we don't want to inundate a Jewish state with non-Jews, Christians and Muslims. We want to keep it a Jewish state. And this logic seems to somehow be bought by some common people. This is actually more hurtful. I mean, I can understand colonial language. What I don't understand is some common people buying this language. And to me, it's very easy to educate oneself about the situation and understand the language of colonialism and understand the reality of colonialism. The numbers speak for themselves. For example, the number of Palestinian civilians killed compared to the number of Israeli civilians killed is a ratio of about 12 to 1. So, you know, it doesn't take a genius to understand who is killing civilians, you know. So it is obvious, you know. Yeah. But people don't want to hear the facts because they like to hear the mythologies of chosen land, of, you know, Exodus. There was a movie about Exodus, you know.
You know, when you talk about the mythology versus the facts, it occurs to me, I've been thinking about that a lot in relation to COVID-19, you know, because like the sort of fantasy based ruler is like any number of people around the world, you know, Trump, Bolsonaro being two very prominent examples. They come face to face with the actual scientific reality that they can't just wish away. I wonder. Talk about the relevance of science, perhaps, a little bit?
Yeah, this is something very interesting. I was reading, when you read, for example, the letters of civil rights, civil war soldiers of, 1860s, you find that people were much more intelligent then, were looking for facts. They were educated. They read books. Now people are reading tweets of Donald Trump as if they are the facts of the world, you know? I think as a species, we're not advancing if we're going from knowledge-based societies and books and reading and facts and information to tweets and short one-sentence things that statements of bullshit, basically, sorry about my language, that they use as if it's a fact, you know? Well, you can understand why people start to, because their mindset is not trained to check the facts. As a scientist, I'm always puzzled by this phenomenon of how people ignore facts and they focus on emotional again, one sentence kind of sloganism that lets them gets off the hook. After all, well, there's riots in America, so it must be that the black people are bad people. They are rioting, and that's it. They don't want to go beyond that. They don't want to get deeper in that. They don't want to understand the systematic, meticulous injustice of slaverism, civil rights, Black Lives Matter. They don't want to understand. They don't. That requires some thinking, and that requires spending ATPs, energy, you know, and they don't want to spend that energy. They just want to spout the sloganism, and they do. And they end up voting for people like Donald Trump. I mean, 60 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. I mean, let's not underestimate this number, you know?
Yeah, right.
60 million Americans voted for a clown, for an idiot, for a misogynist, for somebody who is a womanizer, somebody who cares about nobody else but himself. Even his own sister, on recording that was released, said, "This is a guy that's amazing. He lies and lies and lies." And 60 million people voted, and they voted for him. This is America. And then, you know, but I don't want to make it like I am a Democrat, by the way. I'm not. I mean, when the Democrats had their candidate, and he was clearly the most popular candidate, Bernie Sanders, and then they made the revolution against him, the elites, basically, and they put this clown, another clown by the name of Biden, to be a representative. He would never have been voted for by the primaries or anything like that, but the Democratic National Committee did to Bernie Sanders in 2000 what they did to him in 2016 when they put Clinton in charge. And they may lose the election, by the way. Trump might win.
Right. And does it give you any little sliver of hope, the possibility that if Biden did get in, or does it just it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that would make much difference anyway?
I think actually you would be surprised at my answer. I think Donald Trump is accelerating the demise of the U.S. empire.
Mm.
Somebody like Obama and Biden, they are for the U.S. empire. Obama, for example, bombed several countries while he was in office and killed as many people as the person before him. But they delay the demise of the empire, people like Biden and Obama. So in that sense, maybe, you know, I don't wish America bad things, but it seems that they are going to get bad things one way or the other. It's just that if they want to delay it, they should elect Biden. If they want to accelerate it, they should elect Trump. But bottom line is they need a change in the system. They need a revolution. That's what Black Lives Matter is calling for. That's what the Occupy movement called for. That's why young Americans flock to people like Bernie Sanders or Rashida Tlaib or some of the members of Congress who are in that squad of five, you know, Octavia, what's her name, Cortez.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I think the young people in America are the future, and they must force these old guard, whether it's Biden or Trump, to finally leave us alone so that we can live and we can let other countries live.
Have you, I know you're following events over here closely, I'm sure. And what are your, can you talk more about your impressions of the movement that's been growing over the past few months all over the country?
I think it's remarkable that demonstrations are happening despite the fear of COVID-19. I think it's really indicates the depth of the hurt that the population, and I'm not just talking about Black population, poor white people, Hispanic people, everybody who's really been disenfranchised by a system that promotes corporate interests ahead of people interests, that promotes Zionism as opposed to American public interest. The general public is my impression of what's happening in the U.S. because I communicate with all the people there on the ground. I am optimistic. I'm optimistic that the U.S. will eventually succeed in getting rid of this old guard.
One of the things that occurs to me over here is how, at first, when there would be demonstrators shot or wounded or killed, it was big news. And when there were demonstrations happening in different cities, it was big news. But then, as the demonstrations continue and as more people continue to be killed by right wingers driving cars into crowds or firing at people, it becomes less and less sort of headline news. And it reminds me also of the way how with the Great March of Return, the first massacre was big news. The second massacre was big news. And then after that, a massacre every Friday for over a year, without exception, I believe. And it just disappeared from the news. It got to the point where it wasn't hardly even showing up in my Twitter feed. And I had to search I would do a search on Friday to find news reports. And sometimes the only news reports I'd find were on Al Jazeera, at least in English. It was not being covered at all in the Western press.
Yes, and it's problematical for us because without information, people cannot act. They don't understand what's going on. They don't understand, for example, that over 1 million people in Hasaka in Syria today are thirsty. The Turkish occupation forces, supported by the West inside Syria, have cut off the water to a whole city.
To a million people.
1 million people. Where is that on the news? I don't see it.
Nowhere.
You know, it's remarkable to me. But after all, they are Arabs, so we don't care. I think this level of racism, this level of, you know, Martin Luther King, his letter, I remember, from Birmingham jail was the most poignant letter as I've ever read.
Mm.
And he said he's not, you know, he's not bothered much by the white racists as much as he was by the indifferent people, the apathetic people, and even the so-called white liberals who claim they are for human rights. But they told him, hey, calm down, you know, things will come in due course. Or they told him, look, why don't you just stick to talking about civil rights? Why do you need to talk about Vietnam and what our country is doing in Vietnam? And Martin Luther King was most bothered by this, not by the racists who were killing black people, as much as by the majority of the people of the white elite who shrugged their shoulders, said, what can I do? You know, it's not my problem. Let me just move on with my life. It's what empowered Nazis in Germany. It's what empowered fascist movements. And it's what empowers Donald Trump and all the fascists in the U.S. around him. The same kind of indifference. And at least for people like you, you look for it. You go find. If you can't find it here, you find it there. But most people, they don't want to find it. They're just happy where they are. Why should they? They say, hey, I'm okay. I'm doing okay. Let me worry about myself.
Yeah. Although, as you were mentioning before, so many people are looking for information. Like, you know, after 9/11, the Quran became a bestseller in the U.S., right? And because so many people just thought, well, maybe this is a place to look for information. I mean, it might have been not a very intelligent place to look necessarily, but it was, you know, you credit people with trying, right? And then after the killing of George Floyd, you know, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, became a bestseller, and it's a 10-year-old book. You know, that doesn't usually happen. You know, here in the U.S. right now, we have a Category 4 hurricane bearing down on the Texas-Louisiana coast, and at the same time, we have the biggest wildfires that California has ever seen. And what is the role of climate change in your neck of the woods?
Well, I'm glad you asked me this question. You know, the Earth has been under assault by our species for decades. Ever since the Industrial Revolution, basically, we have moved to kill our home, basically. It's the only home we know as a species. This is our planet, and we're killing it, literally. And the Earth is sending us signals. And these signals, like the fires in California, which are like two times more than last year, and last year was worse than the year before, and so on. The hurricanes, which will increase, and the pandemics, by the way. Pandemics are also a symptom of an ailing Earth, because do we have a pandemic? Because humans are getting too many people interacting with wildlife, bringing wildlife to eat and so forth, and transmittal zoonosis, we call it in science, transmittal of viruses and pathogens from animals to human. And not only that, the number of deaths, if you look at number of deaths related to pollution, why is North Italy, for example, had so many deaths? It's because the pollution is highest in North Italy. So the planet is sending us a lot of messages. Again, you know, some people like you and me look for this information, find them, connect the dots, understand what our responsibility is, and start to act on them. Other people, they just shrug their shoulders. Ah, there is a piece of information here about the hurricane, and a piece of information here about wildfires, and a piece of information here about Trump saying you take disinfectant, maybe it'll kill the virus. This is how they think. They think in these disjointed bits of sloganism without really understanding what is going on. And I think the Earth will keep sending us signals, and these signals will intensify. I am hoping that enough people wake up before it's too late, before we actually have no hope. And we would be like these lemmings that run off the cliff by our own power, basically. I hope, I pray, I work towards that. And you and I understand that we need to work much harder, and we need to wake up more people. And, part of it, the reason I do these interviews almost every day with people on the internet is because we want to get the message out.
Yeah. Climate change has really transformed the climate in Syria and Iraq, and agriculture there, in addition to the consequences of war, like agriculture there has been totally transformed, right? A lot of things just don't grow anymore. Is that?
Yeah, the climate change is devastating food supplies around the world, by the way.
Yeah.
And it really, because you cannot predict rainfall, for example, or the crops that are used to be produced in certain areas are no longer able to be produced. The way it shifts and changes, the way sometimes in very unpredictable ways, as a scientist, sometimes I struggle to understand its impact. For example, apparently there's a lot of elk dying. And the reason they are dying in North America, a lot of elk and so forth, is because they have ticks on them. And the ticks used to be killed by very severe winters. And now there is no severe winter, so the tick population is growing rapidly. And you can see Lyme disease starting to increase and so on. So there's a lot of very things that are happening that need to be understood in the context of climate change. And we scientists do research on this. I published many papers along those lines of human impact on the environment and impact of habitat destruction and environmental changes on populations and on agriculture, on fauna and flora and so forth. We need to do a lot more research, but more important, we need to take the results of this research
do something.
Do something, yes. To say enough. Yeah, look at, there will be more plastic in the oceans in 5 years than there are fish in the oceans,
Mm.
This is remarkable. 40% of coral reefs are already gone. And another 40% is beginning to show that whitening symptoms of removal of the coral reefs. We've already killed more species of animals. There are species dying. In the hour I was with you here, we're about to finish an hour. In the hour I was with you, several species went extinct. Many of them are things we have never even seen. We don't even know exist because we didn't have a chance to describe them as scientists. The world is really needs to awaken to this dramatic change that humans are inducing in our planet. And this is, I would say this is our biggest challenge now.
It's interesting that Lyme disease is one of those phenomena that has to do with climate change and it's how it's spreading with the elk and stuff, because it's really quite devastating. I grew up in Connecticut, where you lived for a long time, and I don't know if you avoided getting Lyme disease, but I've known so many people who have been totally debilitated.
Yeah, many of my friends got it. Yes. No, I mean there are so many effects that acid rain, for example, reduces the ability of birds to absorb calcium from their environment. So the eggshells of birds are becoming thinner and thinner. The reproduction success of wild birds is lower. We see all sorts of effects that are amazing that we don't even think about, and you know, invasive species increasing around the world, and destroying habitats and destroying other things, you know. I mean, there's oil spills, for example, now in Mauritius, an area of coral reefs, and nobody's talking. The media, Western media, is not covering it much.
No, it's so much. I recently been, you know, watching Al Jazeera. If you want to know, if you want to have any idea what's happening outside of the U.S., it seems, even on BBC or something, it just. Yeah, my toddler is calling himself Al Jazeera now, so I might be watching too much Al Jazeera. I'm not sure. It's his favorite music.
But you also have to be careful. Al Jazeera is funded by Qatar.
Yeah.
And so Al Jazeera criticizes everybody and everything, unless it's Qatar associated. For example, Qatar and Turkey are now friends, so you won't see any coverage of the water shortage in Al-Hasakah in Syria.
No.
And the besiege of Syria on Al Jazeera. You would see it on other places that hate Turkey or hate Qatar.
Yeah, that's been very evident. Yeah, that's why I stopped watching it for so long. But then there's just a lot of information. It's hard to find anywhere else. But yeah, when they're covering the Middle East, it's the bias is really obvious, the anti-Iranian bias. Yeah.
They did a wonderful series on the Israel lobby and how it influenced, how it dictated politics in Britain, and they were expanding it to go to the U.S. and cover APAC and how it influences U.S. elections. The U.S. pressured them to shut it down. So after they funded this series of videos, they didn't air them on Al Jazeera or anywhere else. But somebody apparently found them and leaked them, and now they are available on YouTube.
Oh, good. So, last question, Mazen. I know you mentioned Trump as an accelerant, but do you think there will be an election in the United States in November? You want to make any predictions on that?
Yes, there will be an election. I think Trump, if he loses, he's going to contest it, and maybe he can succeed in hanging on to power because a Supreme Court is stacked in his favor, or in Republican favor, I should say. So we'll see. I mean, I don't know what will happen, but I do know this, that it is important for people to act in between elections more than what to act at the elections.
Yeah.
When we got women's right to vote in the U.S., when we got civil rights, when we got to end the war in Vietnam, when we got 40-hour work week, when we got laws about unionizations and right to unionize labor, all of these positive things, you know, social security, etc., all of them happened not because we elected somebody versus another. They happened because we, the people, and that's a very important, we the people can push whoever is in power, whether it's Biden or Trump or whoever, to do the right thing. And the politicians do this. They stick their finger in the air and see where the wind is blowing. And we have to provide the hurricane
to
literally get them to move.
Provide the hurricane. Excellent. Yes, indeed. Mazen Kumsia, thanks so much for joining me for the hour. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, David.
See you again.
Take care.
And thanks, everybody, for tuning into this conversation with Mazen Kumsia. You can find all of these discussions archived in various places, including on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovix in the Discussions with David playlist. You'll also find them all in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform, or just go to davidrovix.com. If you want to support my broadcasting efforts, you're most welcome to become a patron at patreon.com/davidrovix, where all of these broadcasts are also available for anyone to download, along with some patron-only offerings as well. If you're in the Portland or Oregon area, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up to receive text notifications so you can be part of Portland emergency eviction response when the investment banks that own half of the city start trying to evict so many of our neighbors. If you want to help make my next album a multi-instrumental success, check out davidrovics.com/pandemic sessions. And if you want to hear a live concert from my living room, tune in to this very channel wherever you're watching on at 1 p.m. Pacific on Saturday, 9 p.m. GMT. Remember, don't pay the rent. Don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.